Good evening, and welcome to a special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew would like to wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. Now, we hope you enjoyed this special Christmas presentation from the Scuttlebutt Radio Network.
December 1944, the battered German army launched its last great offensive along an 85-mile front at Belgium's Ardennes Forest, the infamous Battle of the Bulge. Nearly 16,000 American soldiers would lose their lives. Another 60,000 would be wounded or captured. It was the costliest battle the United States would wage in any war. Within earshot of the fight, on the edge of the Ardennes Forest, stood a small, isolated cabin. There, Fritz Vincken, a 12-year-old German boy, lived with his mother, Elizabeth. Fritz's father, Hubert, had moved his family to the cabin for safekeeping. But life in the forest was difficult. While Hubert served as a civilian baker for the German army 20 miles away, Fritz and his mother struggled to put food on the table.
My father thought, like everybody else, that the war would be ended, would be over by Christmas, but it was not to be. And our stay in this shack was longer than we anticipated.
Christmas Eve 1944 arrived with an air of sadness and uncertainty. Hubert has still not returned, and his family was resigned to the fact that they would be spending the holiday without him.
Ich weiß, heute ist Weihnachten. Aber weißt du, wenn kommen könnte, würde bestimmt da sein. Bestimmt.
Fritz's mother tried to make the evening as festive as possible. She scraped together a Christmas meal of a few potatoes and a scrawny rooster.
Papa?
My mother blew out the candle and went to the door, and I went with her. She opened the door, and there were these soldiers.
Ja, bitte?
Good evening, ma'am. Do you speak English?
Nein.
We're Americans.
They tried to talk to us, but my mother didn't speak English.
Our friend's been shot. Can we come inside for a while, please?
My mother just looked, and she looked at the guy sitting in the snow.
Kommt rein.
Thank you.
Until finally my mother, after it seems to be like an eternity to me, she asked them to come in.
Hier aufs Bett, da ist es am besten.
Fritz's mother knew full well that harboring the enemy was punishable by death, but she was more than willing to take the risk. The injured soldier had been shot in the leg and had lost a great deal of blood. Elizabeth did her best to make him comfortable.
What's she saying? I don't know. Ask her if she speaks French. Parlez-vous français?
Mais oui. Vous êtes séparés de votre armée?
Oui, madame.
He said that they had lost their unit and were wandering through the Ardennes for the past 2 days and two nights.
Je vais changer les bandages.
She's going to change his bandage.
Fritz, hol doch bitte mal das Tuch. Dann reiß ich.
My mother was all motherhood. She worried for them and she worried for the wounded man. And she did everything she could. They were very nice. Like big boys from the neighborhood, you know.
So how you doing, kid? Have a nice Christmas, son boy?
Fritz's mother made the American GIs feel right at home.
He doesn't understand a word we're saying.
The men began to relax in anticipation of an unexpected Christmas dinner.
We thought automatically this must be more Americans. And I went to the door and opened the door. And there were four German soldiers.
Fröhliche Weihnachten.
I was petrified with fear.
Aber wir wurden von unserem Regiment getrennt. Wir haben uns verlaufen.
He said, we have lost our unit and we would like to warm up a little bit.
Sie können auch mit uns zu Abend essen.
So my mother said, you not only be allowed to warm up, but you get a nice dinner. If you accept our guests.
Das für Gäste, Amerikaner etwa?
Ja. Einer davon ist genauso müde wie Sie auch.
And my mother said, this is Christmas night and there will be no shooting around here.
Legt eure Waffen da ab.
Put your arms in the wooden shed. And then we come out and have a nice, nice Christmas.
Das Essen ist schon fast fertig.
Tut, was ich sage. Legt die Waffen auf den Haufen ab und kommt rein. Ich habe Hunger.
Meanwhile, my mother had turned to the Americans, who by then had noticed that some Germans were coming, and had turned to their guns also.
Je vais les garder jusqu'à demain. Merci. Fritz, so, jetzt gehst du noch ein paar Kartoffeln holen.
My mother said to me, get more potatoes and more water. We had more mouth to feed.
Setzen Sie sich doch, bitte. Essen ist gleich fertig.
For about a minute or two, maybe three, there was a tension.
Guten Abend. Hello.
But then it was warm, it smelled good, and right away there was a sense of hospitality.
You speak English? Yes, a little. Your comrade, he's wounded?
Yeah, he got a round in the thigh earlier.
One of the German soldiers went over to the American that were wounded and asked the Americans in English, what was wrong with him?
So what do you think?
He's lucky. He's lost a lot of blood, but the cold has prevented the wound from getting infected. He should recover, provided he gets some rest and nourishment.
Good, good.
He had some first aid kit, and he applied a dressing to the wound. And the whole evening, he would every now and then go and look after him.
That night, hostilities ceased in at least one corner of the forest as American and German soldiers sat down together to honor the Christmas spirit.
My mother said grace.
Lieber Herrgott, wir danken dir.
It was not a regular prayer, it was something spontaneous. And she said that let's all thank the Lord for being together tonight, peaceful in this terrible war. And let's enjoy dinner, the little things that we have, and let's promise to be friendly to each other forever if possible. Let's also pray for an end of this terrible war so that we all can go home very soon. And by that time they were all crying. Not profusely, but the tears were rolling, you know, even the German sergeant, I was very surprised. And then we ate and the tears disappeared. But from then on, there was a feeling of friendship that permeated the whole room. It was wonderful. I never forget.
After dinner, the soldiers drifted outside one by one. Elizabeth and Fritz soon joined them. As they gazed heaven, each gave thanks in his own way. That night, the men would sleep side by side under the same roof, the differences of war temporarily set aside.
They were so peaceful. You never think that there are two different kinds of soldiers that one day before they would have shot each other.
Sie gehen hier am Bach entlang.
Fritz remembers that the spirit of brotherhood continued the next morning. The German soldiers helped construct a makeshift stretcher for the injured GI and then gave the Americans directions back to their line.
So you come to the railroad tracks.
That same day, Fritz and his mother left with the Germans and were soon reunited with Fritz's father.
You're listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. for listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. And now the special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network continues.
Such great enthusiasm. 1 million men volunteered in the first week alone. It would be a great patriotic adventure. But the fast-moving battles of summer and autumn failed to bring a decisive victory for either side. Now, it's December. And cavalry charges have given way to standing in holes. Two vast armies, each 1 million strong, face each other, stopped dead in the mud. And no one is quite sure what to do next. Lieutenant Sir Edward Hamilton Westrow Hulse of the Scots Guards, like all officers, is expected to set an example. But when faced with an enemy who refuses to behave like one, he finds the normal rules of engagement don't apply.
You're too close!
He could order his men to fire, but the enemy is unarmed, and that would be murder.
Go back!
He could take them prisoner.
Do you understand?
But it just doesn't seem right. Not today.
What do you want?
Good morning, sir. We just wanted to wish you all a Merry Christmas.
Thank you. And the same to you, I'm sure.
Oh, and we would like to bury our dead, as you can see.
Yes, of course. We should do the same.
Oh, naturally, you may do that. You must only come. We have many of your men lying in front of us.
Yes, I know. Your English is exceptionally good.
I used to live in Suffolk. My girl is still there, with my motorbike. 3.5 horsepower, beautiful bike.
This is the first time Hulse has actually met the enemy, and he is not overly impressed.
The little fellow I was talking to was an undersized, pasty-faced student. I taught 4 languages well and had a business in England, so I mistrusted him at once.
Would you take a letter for me? I can't get it through to her.
Very well. You'd better write it here.
The war that Hulse has trained so long to fight has suddenly been reduced to small talk, and social encounters have even more minefields than military ones.
I'll see what I can do, but I can't imagine Trump in the least bit keen to see you again.
Yeah.
Ghastly wounds these high-velocity rounds make. Especially at this range. Hmm. Oh, we should use the old South African round nose bullet. That makes a very clean hole.
We don't want to fight this war. Not today, not ever. But we are ordered to do it.
The British Army is almost entirely professional.
Thank you, sir.
The German Army is mostly conscript. But Hulse finds it hard to believe that this degenerate sentiment is widespread even among the enemy. He certainly won't believe it of his own men.
All right, then, carry on.
Hulse goes to check that the Germans aren't bothering his men elsewhere, leaving strict instructions for everyone to remain at their posts. But he finds trench after trench completely deserted. It doesn't take long to solve the mystery. The sound of singing guides him to his lost sheep. While Hulse was engaging in small talk, most of his regiment took the opportunity to attend a carol concert with the Germans. Hulse's duty as an officer is to take control of this dangerous situation. And he does.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary. To the sweetest girl I know.
Taking the most pragmatic course, Hulse decides that his men deserve a day off. He chooses to ignore the fact that they're sharing it with the enemy. Until his commanding officer arrives. Captain George Painter is the last word in authority for Hulse and his men, and the last chance to call a halt before word reaches HQ.
Merry Christmas to you.
But instead of stopping the party...
Well, chaps, I brought a little something for you.
He fuels it with Fortnum and Mason's rum. At this moment in time, there are dozens of similar scenes all along the Western Front. A collection of isolated outbreaks. By midday, nearly half the British frontline army is involved in the truce. Each soldier receives a gift of tobacco from a grateful royal family. 300,000 have been sent to the front, along with plum puddings, extra scarves, hats, and a pin-up of Princess Mary. All perfect material for bartering with the Germans. Earlier this morning, Rifleman Williams got a regimental belt, while a friend went one better and acquired a prized Pickelhauber helmet. The British High Command is worried, but not nearly worried enough. So far, they have just seen the tip of a very large iceberg. The sheer scale of the truce will not become clear for days when all the individual pieces are put together. Cameras are officially banned, but High Command has not yet bothered to enforce the ban. They will soon change their minds. Letters and pictures find their way straight to the front pages. Mail is uncensored. This oversight will also soon be corrected, but not before the damage has been done. Everywhere this Christmas afternoon, events are taking on a life of their own, helped by the former skills of Civvy Street. Artists and artisans from every walk of life. And someone in a Lancashire regiment must have been a clairvoyant, because he's brought the perfect accessory for a day off at the front. A football.
Cheese, my cheese!
The same scene is repeated in a dozen places, with tin cans, rolled up sandbags, whatever can be found. With teams of 60 aside, less than perfect pitches, scores, like the ball, disappear in the mess. But the clock is ticking. Reality is about to intrude. And it comes not from senior officers, but from less fortunate friends. In the midst of the revelry, the dead lie unburied. A stark reminder of why they were sent here in the first place. Captain Hulse finds a lost friend, Lieutenant Hugh Taylor, lying by the German trench where he fell 3 nights ago. Without the truce, the fallen would simply lie here to rot. Now, they can have a hero's rest. Enemies are united in death, and now in life too. At Flabey, they agree to bury their dead together. In the same scrap of no man's land, they died to claim. And where yesterday they faced each other in war, now enemies come together in a spirit of Christmas peace.
They say they're not going to fire again if we don't. But of course, we must. It just doesn't seem right to be killing each other at Christmas time.
Sooner or later, the generals will want their soldiers back. They have more and bigger battles to fight. But will these men be ready to fight them? Christmas Day is over. The new year comes and goes. 1 year on, Graham Williams has survived. So has Henry Williamson and Frank Richards. George Painter is wounded. Edward Hulse is dead. This year, there will be no repeat. The common bond of soldiers has been broken by gas and air raids and the murder of prisoners and threats to court-martial fraternizers and shoot deserters has put the final block on any contact. Only one attempt will be made at Neuve Chapelle, in exactly the same place as a year ago. A million casualties in between, and nothing has moved. Next year, another million, and so on for year after year. By the end, half of all soldiers will be dead or wounded.
You're listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. Listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. And now the special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network continues.
Patriots battling to break free from the colonial domination of English rule. The first 14 months of the War for Independence had gone well. After the outbreak of hostilities in April of 1775, the Americans had taken advantage of a smaller British force and had captured Fort Ticonderoga, pressured them out of Boston, and had nearly conquered Canada. By mid-1776, though, the tide of war had shifted. The largest British expeditionary force ever assembled up to that time arrived in America. And George Washington's Continental Army was pushed nearly to the breaking point. New York City fell to the British, along with New Jersey by year's end. However, Washington's famous counterattacks at Trenton, Christmas night 1776, and at Princeton, January 3rd, 1777, breathed new life into the cause of liberty. As the combatants prepared for the third year of war, Washington's challenge would be to prevent further British advances. Thus, the stage was set for the campaign of 1777. The British, from their base in Canada, launched an attack designed to isolate New England, while from New York City, another campaign targeted the Patriot capital, Philadelphia. But the attempt to isolate New England failed when, in October, British General John Burgoyne was forced to surrender at Saratoga. Meanwhile, General Sir William Howe moved by sea to Maryland and marched northward toward Philadelphia. Attempting to stop the British advance, Washington was outmaneuvered and defeated at Brandywine on September 11th. British forces entered Philadelphia in late September. Washington tried to regain control of the capital with an attack at Germantown on October 4th. His troops, though courageous, were thrown back by the disciplined, experienced British. Their army intact and morale still high, the Americans retreated to a temporary camp at White Marsh. In early December, with the British in firm control of Philadelphia, Washington sought a winter encampment site, which would allow him to watch the British, remain beyond reach of a surprise attack, and prevent the British occupation of Pennsylvania's richest farming region. Valley Forge was such a place. And on December 19th, 1777, the army moved to winter quarters and began building their camp.
For the men of the army, building the huts was a welcome relief from the waiting at White Marsh. It was something to do, a way to keep warm. The troops formed into 12-man squads, each to build its own living quarters. Tools were scarce, and timber had to be dragged to the hut sites. With one of every four men unfit for duty, construction proceeded slowly, General Washington, complaining about the shortages and their effects, wrote,
"We have, by a field return this day, made no less than 2,898 men now in camp unfit for duty because they are barefoot or naked."
Naked meant the soldiers' clothes were extremely ragged, or that their uniforms were totally inadequate. In spite of the obstacles, the work proceeded. Competition was encouraged between the squads. The $12 reward General Washington had offered for the first properly constructed hut in each regiment, and the desire to be under shelter, drove the builders. One cabin was completed by December 21st, and most men were under roof within a month. Colonel Timothy Pickering, writing to his wife on January 5th.
"The huts are very warm and comfortable, being very good log houses, pointed with clay."
In a journal entry dated January 6th, Dr. Albigens Waldo, a surgeon with the 1st Connecticut Regiment, wrote,
"We have got our huts to be very comfortable and feel ourselves happy in them."
Though better than tents, the quality of the huts varied from squad to squad. Comfort was a relative thing, depending on where you found yourself, where you were from, and what you were used to. The 1st Connecticut was camped at the base of Mount Joy, along the inner defense line. Relatively well supplied with clothing by their home state, they were among the best equipped troops at Valley Forge. Just a half mile west, the North Carolina troops were very poorly supplied and ranked among the worst equipped. Though the situation in each regiment varied, the troops were generally ill-equipped to deal with the harsh winter before them. Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Carleton of Massachusetts stated,
"We have near 90 men in the regiment that have not a shoe to their foot, and near as many who have no feet to their stockings."
And an unidentified Rhode Islander complained,
"Nakedness and misery, our distressed troops and countrymen undergo at Valley Forge, whilst those of other states are much better provided for."
In spite of the shortages, each day had its duties and the activities of camp continued. The Valley Forge winter was generally moderate, though frequent rains and occasional snow persisted throughout the encampment. From reveille at dawn till tattoo after dark, the routine of winter grew tiresome for the cold, hungry troops. There were fortifications to be built, although shortages of tools and the need to complete winter quarters slowed progress. Wood had to be cut and fires continually fed. Pickets stood guard duty, and efforts to drill the troops continued. Spurred by great need, foraging expeditions under General Anthony Wayne and General Nathaniel Green achieved some success in procuring supplies, which included wheat, cattle, flour, and whiskey. Still, these efforts were hampered by problems the commissary itself continually encountered. Farmers and merchants with goods to sell frequently favored the British hard currency to the nearly worthless continental scrip. Too few wagons, poor communications, profiteering, and a woefully inadequate road system combined to interfere with the flow of supplies to Valley Forge. And so the encampment existed on a subsistence level. In a letter to Washington, General James Varnum of Rhode Island pointed out,
"According to the sayings of Solomon, hunger will break through a stone wall. 3 days successively we have been without bread. 2 days we have been entirely without meat. The men must be supplied, or they cannot be commanded."
In the face of growing adversity, the men held on, as supplies fluctuated dramatically, an agonizing aspect of any day became waiting for the creak of an arriving wagon train or the bellow of cattle being driven into camp. In his diary entry for January 7th, Christopher Marshall recorded,
10 teams of oxen fit for slaughtering came into camp driven by loyal Philadelphia women."
A little more than a month later, in a letter to his father, John Lorenz of South Carolina wrote,
"We have lately been in a most alarming situation for want of provisions. Those who are employed to feed us, either for want of knowledge or for want of activity or both, never furnish supplies adequate to our needs."
Most times from the middle of January on, the men could supplement their meager rations with purchases at one of the markets established in the camp. There, salt, vinegar, potatoes, or vegetables were available at fixed prices for those soldiers who had money. Quantities at the markets were limited, though, and often pay lagged. As Francis Dana, an observer, noted in February,
"For flour they had not suffered, but upon an average, every brigade has been destitute of fish or flesh for days. We do not see from whence the supplies of meat are to come. The want of it will infallibly bring on a mutiny in the army."
Firecake, an abounding affection for their commander, and a healthy respect for the risks of desertion kept the army together in its most difficult times.
February was probably the worst month of the encampment. Plagued by disease, desertion, and expiring enlistments, the army shrank from 12,000 to 6,000. Conditions and shortages combined to strain the already weakened force. Sickness reached epidemic proportions, fueled by poor sanitation and damp, overcrowded quarters. Serious ailments, typhoid, typhus, dysentery, and pneumonia, usually meant removal from camp. The army, according to common practice, established hospitals outside the camp, some as far away as Ephrata, 30 miles distant. But many of the sick chose to suffer in silence rather than be transported to one of these general hospitals, separated from friends and familiar surroundings. Inadequate facilities and shortages of blankets and medicines hampered the efforts of dedicated doctors and surgeons. Local women and camp followers were recruited to help care for the sick in the hospitals. Washington, concerned as always with the welfare of his soldiers, wrote,
"I sincerely feel for the unhappy conditions of our poor fellows in the hospitals. It is but too melancholy a truth that our hospital stores are exceedingly scanty and deficient in every way."
Mortality rates were high at the general hospitals. Many of the 2,000 men who died that winter did so at hospitals far away from the encampment itself. Doctors and surgeons were also hampered by a lack of medical knowledge. Antiseptic and anesthesia were unknown, and contagious disease was not fully understood. For every man killed in combat, roughly 10 died of disease. One of the few successes of the medical effort was the smallpox inoculation program that held that dreaded disease in check. The arrival of spring brought renewed hope to the camp. Morale among the troops rose. With Nathaniel Greene, newly appointed quartermaster general, in firm control of the quartermaster department, and with roads and rivers becoming more passable, supplies flowed regularly. Increasing amounts of food, clothing, weapons, and equipment arrived in camp. As the weather warmed, activity in the camp increased. Units that had wintered elsewhere were recalled, and new recruits coming in raised the strength of the army to nearly 20,000.
Oh!
In March, the retraining of the army began in earnest under General von Steuben.
Take ready. Take aim. Fire!
Upon his arrival in February, Baron Friedrich von Steuben, a former Prussian officer, had found an army without uniform training and lacking adequate discipline. Washington, recognizing Steuben's administrative talents, appointed him Inspector General, with the task of retraining the army under one system.
Half cock, firelock.
He wrote a simplified American training manual, expanded drilling, and began reshaping the Continental Army. Confidence and skill grew daily. News of the newly signed alliance with France further buoyed the spirits of the troops.
Firelock.
Exercise and fresh air were a welcome change from the dank, cramped cabins. Fortifications were complete. Drilling expanded. New weapons and equipment issued as Washington and his generals planned the Army's next move.
That move came on June 19, 1778, when the Continental Army, pursuing the British who had withdrawn from Philadelphia, marched out of Valley Forge. 9 days later, at the Battle of Monmouth in New Jersey, the British met a resupplied Continental Army, larger, better trained, and more unified than ever before. The Americans demonstrated the lessons learned at Valley Forge. And in the end, it was the British who were forced to withdraw. Bound by determination and training, a renewed Continental Army had taken the field with a spirit strengthened at Valley Forge. A spirit that would carry Washington's seasoned veterans 3 more years to victory at Yorktown in 1781 and beyond.
You're listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. You're listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network. Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas. And now the special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network continues. Back in the winter of 1914, there had been an unofficial truce between the British and German forces on Christmas Day. This was not that war. Christmas and the Battle of the Bulge in Bastogne, 1944, the 101st Airborne Division is surrounded by German forces.
On December 22nd, 1944, at about 11:30 in the morning, a group of four German soldiers, waving two white flags, approached the American lines from south of Bastogne. One of them spoke English. He said, "I want to see the commanding officer of this section." The Germans explained that they had a written message to be presented to the American commander in Bastogne. Two American soldiers took two of the four Germans to the command post. There, they delivered a letter to the USA commander of the encircled town of Bastogne. "The fortune of war is changing. This time, the USA forces in and near Bastogne have been encircled by a strong German armored units. There's only one possibility to save the encircled USA troops from total annihilation. That is the honorable surrender of the encircled town. In order to think it over, a term of 2 hours will be granted, beginning with the presentation of this note. If this proposal should be rejected, one German artillery corps and six heavy AA battalions are ready to annihilate the USA troops in and near Bastogne. The order for firing will be given immediately after this 2 hour term. All the serious civilian losses caused by this artillery fire would not correspond with the well-known American humanity." The German commander. Upon hearing the news, General McAuliffe responded, "Nuts." When deciding what a reply to send, the Americans agreed that nothing could beat McAuliffe's original response. This official reply was typed up and sent back, December 22nd, 1944, to the German commander, "Nuts," the American commander. When telling the troops about McAuliffe's response, the American command said, "We were giving our country and our loved ones at home a worthy Christmas present. We're being privileged to take part in this gallant feat of arms and truly making for ourselves a Merry Christmas. A Merry Christmas to you all, and God bless you."
Albert Tarbell, Company H, 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division, and company are driving west in a field near Bastogne.
"We were moving out to another area, a position southwest of Bastogne. We watched P-38 strafing German tanks and infantry. As usual, we didn't know what was going on, except for the rumors that we were floating down to us enlisted men. Everything was chaos. The company commander told us that due to the attack by General Patton's forces to the south, and another group pushing in from the west, we had to move back to another line of defense. We started moving out at approximately 2,000 hours. I ended up in the front of a column quite a few times. As we were moving along, the engineers were blowing down the trees onto the road to place obstacles in the path of the German tanks and infantry. We could hear armor right behind us. Whether they were ours or the enemy's, we did not know. It was past midnight when we reached our destination. The next order was to fire all weapons at the wooded area we had backed up from. I was pointed at the road area to my right front. We got the command to fire, which I did. There was a German Panther tank on the road. He fired at the same time I did. My round knocked his tank out, and his hit our tank, as it was in recoil and gouged some steel out of the tank, shearing sprocket bolts out of the right side front track area. After a few minutes of intense firing, everything went silent. What a Christmas Eve it was.
Tonight, Tom shares the microphone for a very special Scuttlebutt Network Christmas tirade entitled "'Twas the Night Before Christmas in D.C.," with an homage to Clement Clark Moore. Now snuggle up on this cold winter's night for the telling of A Night Before Christmas.
"'Twas the night before Christmas and all through D.C. Not a creature was stirring. They'd all left, you see. In their Learjets and limos, they've fled the Beltway, heading home for vacations that would last until May. In betwixt the impeachment of Trump, the polls passed a budget kicking us in the rump. There'll always be money, exclaimed Pocahontas, as they tried to foist Medicare for All upon us. Vive la Revolution, exclaimed Ilhan Omar. On display was her ignorance both near and far. And Nancy Pelosi, with her smile full of sat down with Chris Matthews for softballs to hit. Then in the rotunda there arose such a ruckus that had nothing to do with embracing the suckers. So momentous the occasion occurring within, it gave pause to Mad Cow with her Cheshire Cat grin. From the glow of the fire set for warmth from the cold by our homeless veterans both young and old. Then what to my wondering eyes should appear but a motorcade built for the people to fear. With well-armed drivers on the taxpayer dole, the long lines of limos continue to roll, past the Section 8 housing and the vagrants with packs, past our wounded warriors laying flat in their racks, past the war memorials for all to see. I knew in a moment it must be Pelosi. More rapid than IRS agents they came, I think she teared up as she called them by name. Now Nadler, now Sanders, now Blumenthal and Schiff, on Comey and Brennan, and Page and Strzok. To hell with Horowitz and damn you, Bill Barr, it's time for impeachment to shine like a star. Because the people are restless and they're threatening our jobs, we'll be out on the streets with those Antifa mobs. So up to the House well, the bureaucrats flew, with handouts for Johnny, free birth control for Sue. Her eyes, how they shone, all glassy and merry. Looks like Pelosi been hitting the sherry. Or maybe the Botox, we're told, is her thing. Heck, maybe the gin from the House cloakroom sink. With the crazy one Adam Schiff close by her side, they could toast to each other, Republicans locked outside. At the taxpayer trough, their great thirst they could slake, while AOC was out to say, we'll all eat green cake. With Schiff's fingers all gnarled and a vent of his spleen, total power was his, just like old Palpatine. Or maybe he's like Mr. Burns from The Simpsons, with money to spare and a thing for the cheerings. Then out on the mall there arose such a clatter, DC cops were dispatched to see what was the matter. Who could be out on a night such as this? We've no more to give, not even a piss. Then what to their hollowed-out eyes should appear but legions of veterans from far and near? With families in tow and legacies to bear, with visions of comrades they would not easily scare. And then, in a twinkling, they saw in the sky shadows cast by the parachutes passing right by. For the oath they had taken had finally kicked in, and our patriots had come in support of their kin. For the budget deal passed and announced with fanfare, in the hopes that the people just wouldn't care, was full of new spending and well lacking in cuts, with our veterans once again kicked in the guts. And oh, had the bureaucrats played the game well, and why not, they could count on the media sell. So forgotten were men fought at beaches like Juno, while the brave politicians cared for numero uno. They were wrapped in the flag from their heads to their feet, and the drum and the fife was their marching to beat. They fell in with precision and accounted for all, and stepped off of the line into Congress's hall. Some were young, some were old, some invisibly scarred, some had purple heart bodies horrifically marred. They had paid for our freedoms abroad and at home, with a 1,000-yard stare and more miles yet to roam. They spoke not a word and went straight to their works, filling stockings with coal and ignoring the jerks, and snapped to attention as if on command, and saluted Old Glory with a war-wearied hand. Both Pelosi and Schiff they then turned their attention and rendered a different salute at their mention. With a steely-eyed glare coming from every face, they fell in once more and took leave of the place. They marched on like ghosts from the future and past, with a spirit our forefathers knew would e'er last. And I heard them exclaim as they marched out of sight, this is just the beginning. We've only begun to fight.
You're listening to a very special Christmas presentation of the Scuttlebutt Radio Network,
Cal, Tom, and the entire crew wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas.